In today's episode, we interview David Luke, Professor in Practice and Strategic Director at the Firoz Lalji Institute for Africa. Specialising in African trade policy and trade negotiations, Professor Luke has decades of experience in policy advisory services, managing and catalysing research, building partnerships, and training and capacity development for private sector and government. His 2023 book, How Africa Trades, draws on the research expertise of LSE's Firoz Lalji Institute for Africa, making sense of the continent's major trade challenges and how African countries engage with often unconducive international trade rules that distort global markets. Recently, he has written about the potential effects of the EU's carbon border tax on African nations. Professor Luke has had an extensive career, including assignments at the African Union, the UN Development Programme and the UN Economic Commission for Africa, where he was instrumental in the preparation of the protocols that make up the AfCFTA. Professor Luke, we are so happy to have you here on the Beverage Report podcast with us. I'd love to first start off and ask you, what first sparked your interest in trade and development in Africa?
It happened serendipitously. I did my thesis, my PhD thesis at SOAS on the port of Freetown, Sierra Leone, and looking more at labor and related organizational issues, for a busy port. But then I realized that the function of the port is actually to facilitate trade. And so that's really what sparked my interest in, wanting to study trade much more deeply.
Right. And you were the editor of the recent book, How Africa Trades, which seeks to help stakeholders better understand Africa's trade challenges and make effective policy decisions. Could you perhaps begin by shedding some light on how the makeup of external trade between Africa and its main trading partners differs from intra-African trading?
Yeah, that aspect, that comes out of the data is truly fascinating. And it's also a very stark contrast that when Africa trades with the rest of the world, and here I'm aggregating all of Africa, of course, 54 countries, it trades mainly commodities. And when it trades with itself, it trades processed products. Although some of these processed products are also food and agricultural products. But the difference is that these are value-added products. And when you think about the supply chain, you realize that behind these products, of course, jobs, technology for processing and so on. So it's a mix that is ideal. a mix that's ideal for economic development. But then, when you look at the export profile, the commodities going to markets outside of Africa, you realize that it's not that impactful on development.
Right. And why would you argue it's important for African countries to break their reliance on commodities exports and avoid the phenomenon of a resource curse, or the paradox in which countries home to valuable natural resources underperform economically?
It's very clear that commodities have these limitations in terms of jobs, in terms of sort of being part of a global value chain and so on. So those limitations are very clear as regards commodities. And no country is dependent on commodities for its development. It's always had to process commodities or use commodities as a basis for industrial development. And for the African countries, that is also something that they need to do. So it's very clear that, they need to get out of the commodities trap, the resource trap. I mean, of course, the political economy is such that with rents and all that, it makes it that kind of production attractive, but clearly it's not sustainable, and we're seeing this in terms of the huge numbers of unemployment, the demographic impact and so on.
Amazing. And why do you think decades-long efforts to diversify to diversify rather, have made little progress? And are current investment flows to Africa helping to generate economic change, or do they simply perpetuate the problem?
Diversification has made little progress because I think the policy framework, and this is something I know you want to discuss further, has not, you know, most African countries have not got the policy framework right. I think external partners have been interested in mainly in resource extraction and in the commodities we've just been talking about, and so that's where the investments have gone. The alibi that is sometimes made is that diversifying into other sectors is too risky for investment and so on. But then you find that, ironically, investment is going into sectors and in countries where you would have thought that, extracting minerals and all that is actually highly risky. But, the kind of narrative that is emerging. Also, capital is, accessing capital is much more expensive. Because of premiums and so on. Although, you know, this is becoming more and more an issue on the international agenda as to why you would have this kind of markup in interest when African countries borrow, which as compared to non-African countries and so on. So this is the mix of the reasons why diversification has not progressed. But I do want to stress the policy issue, which we can come back to, and then of course the pattern of investment.
Great, thank you so much. And pivoting to something slightly different, you and your team played an instrumental role in the preparation of the protocols that make up the African Continental Free Trade Area, and this is the world's largest new free trade area since the establishment of the WTO. So you've previously argued that trade offers of the EU and China, Africa's two main trading partners, fall short of Africa's development needs. Could you explain why this may be the case and perhaps give our listeners an overview of the trade regimes under which Africa currently trades, as well as how the AfCFTA changes things?
Yeah. AfCFTA is an effort to open up trade between African countries. As we said, trade profile of that you find in inter-African trade is much more promising from a development perspective, so it does make sense to open up, liberalize trade between African countries. It does make sense to try to tackle non-tariff barriers from infrastructure to customs reform, red tape, and so on. And so that's what the AfCFTA aims to do. And I know we could also talk about implementation and how well that is going, etc. But then on the other side, yes, indeed, the trade regimes with partners is not helpful to this kind of economic integration that the African countries want to pursue. In the case of the EU, basically, if you look at the map of EU trade policy in Africa, the kind of footprint they have left, they've basically carved up the continent into different sort of factions and so on, at the same time that the continent is wanting to integrate. Africans have found it very difficult to resist this kind of approach with the EU because they're dependent on the EU market. And then what's also ironical about that is that the African countries in aggregate only account for like 3% of EU imports. So it's the African countries are not a major trading partner for the EU. So I have argued that the EU could actually have a trade regime with the African countries that is supportive of the integration efforts that they're trying to make. And then at the same time, that allows African countries to export into the EU without having to do so through these carved up trade regimes. Now, when it comes to China, China is actually the opposite of the EU, whereas the EU, if you like, has been overactive in terms of having a well-laid-out trade policy approach towards Africa. China has been much more stealthy in how it has approach this not really wanting to make commitments as such, and preferring a much more ad hoc kind of approach. China does have a scheme for the poorest African countries, but there isn't much in it. And again, one could argue that, like the EU, what is needed is an open regime that could allow African countries to export into China without restrictions. And we do have a model for that, because we do argue in the book that this is exactly what the US has done. And ironically, the Americans are not taking much credit for this, which is somewhat surprising. But the US has an open regime. African countries can export whatever they have to the US, you know, without tariffs and so on. And we think that that is the model that Africa needs at this stage of its development, not necessarily forever, but as there is economic progress, there is economic development, you could look at having more reciprocal trade regimes. But I think that for the African countries, it's too early at this stage for them to have that.
Thank you so much. So it's great to hear the differences between those trading partners, and you've brushed upon implementation. So given that the pandemic delayed the momentum behind the project, where do things currently stand regarding its implementation?
Pandemic delayed it. And then after the pandemic, as you know, economic crisis, you know, inflation, high interest rates, and debt and so on. So from my perspective, I've been somewhat disappointed that African policymakers have had their attention diverted to these other things. So implementation has not gone as well as I had hoped, and not as quickly and in a fast-paced sort of way, given what I think is the urgency of these sorts of reforms for the African countries. But all the same, it's not that nothing is happening. You know, beginning to see countries trade under the AfCFTA, although still not at the scale that one would like to see. But you know, I guess you know, small beginnings can lead to other things. So one remains optimistic. But, you know, I wouldn't underrate the effect of all the policy difficulties that have followed the pandemic.
Of course. And how do you respond to views held by economists such as Danny Roderick, who worry the rapid growth we have seen in recent decades in sub-Saharan Africa specifically may not be sustainable due to, quote-unquote, poor prospects for industrialization?
Yeah, I'm a fan of Roderick, and I think he's right. I mean, I think his argument is that we are seeing a servicification, an early servicification of African economies, you know, sort of moving from the, you know, sort of classical path from agriculture to industry to services. But African economies seem to be jumping from agriculture to services, and that these are not necessarily high value productive services. So I agree with that. I agree with that kind of analysis. I also think that the policy framework for industrialization is one that African countries really need to look at very carefully. I don't think the issue is about the objectives. I think everybody understands that if you're manufacturing, if you have an industrial profile, higher value goods being produced, you're able to grow much more quickly. We have seen there many examples around the world of this. So it's not the objective. I think it's much more the process now that African countries need to look at. And actually, last year, me and the team here working on African trade policy produced a white paper that we titled in sustainable industrialization in Africa, the art of industrial policy making itself. And the reason why we focused on what we call the art of industrial policy making itself is that we don't see the objectives as the problem, but the process, the policy making process. And that's why I think African countries have come unstuck. As we've seen in East Asia and elsewhere, you can set the objectives, but you need to be able to adapt your policies in the light of changing circumstances, and above all else, that you're not protecting industries as they emerge, and crucially, that they don't become rent-seeking kind of operations, and you avoid cronyism and all that. And there are tools that could be applied to make sure that you don't go down that path. So basically, we're saying that there's need to focus on the policy-making process to get it right, to adapt it from time to time, depending on what sorts of results you're getting. And actually, we're not saying anything new or evolutionary, because a lot of work has been done in this field that has looked at especially the East Asian countries and so on, and lots have been written about this. I'll mention Alice Amsden's work that stands out in this area. So adaptive policymaking, I think, would respond to the concerns of Danny Roderick, that we are not seeing the African countries make progress in transforming their economies. And one last point on this. I think today when we talk about industrialization, we don't necessarily mean what happened in Manchester in the 19th century and so on. I think what we're talking about is how you transform economies to be higher value economies. And that, of course, can entail a mix of sectors that complement each other, high value services like tourism and so on, going hand in hand with agriculture, food production, food processing, manufacturing and so on. So you can have what we're talking about is economic transformation, not so much your classic industrial economy.
Great, thank you. And you've mentioned the importance of focusing on the process and sort of unraveling problems there, rather than there being problems in the objectives. So as the first to study the implications of the EU's CBAM, or Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, on Africa with your team at the LSE, do you think the currently proposed implementation aligns with the programme's aims to put a fair price on carbon and successfully promote cleaner production in non-EU countries?
Again, the work we've done on the CBAM, we do recognise that there is carbon leakage. The EU has an emissions trading system. Many countries don't have that. And the EU puts a price on carbon. Many countries don't do that. So you could have carbon leakage in terms of the EU receiving these sorts of imports that are not up to its own standards on pricing emissions and so on. So I, fully get it and understand where the EU is coming from. I think rather than take a unilateral approach, which is what the EU has done, there is scope to take a multilateral approach to this, because at the end of the day, we're all on the same planet and wanting to see carbon emissions come down and all that. So I think a multilateral approach that brings all countries up to some optimal level, recognizing, of course, that as the Paris Agreement has recognized, that you can have differentiated responsibilities and so on for poorer countries and all that. But I think a global approach would have been much better than the unilateral approach that the EU has taken. And also, I think it can potentially punish countries that are struggling with controlling emissions. So I think that there is scope for the EU to rethink the policy, especially now that it seems to be spreading. We see the UK is wanting to adopt something, similar policy and so on. I was somewhat disappointed that this issue was not at all discussed at the COP, even though there's work that has been done by various groups prior to the last COP, the COP28. But nonetheless, it is still on the agenda, this question of having a global carbon price, even if it's a differentiated price, the question of taxing carbon emissions, which again, we could take a global approach, the question of subsidies, this disciplining subsidies, especially on fossil fuels and so on. So the scope for global approaches that could arrive at the same objective of wanting to deal with this problem of carbon leakage, which is what the CBAM tries to address in the EU context, but doing so in I think in a sort of self-indulgent kind of way for the EU.
Right. And what steps do you believe Africa ought to take to best prepare itself for the CBAM?
I think future growth in Africa has to be greener. I think everybody recognizes that, and because that's the way the rest of the planet is going and has to go. And I think that's fully understood. So I think at this stage, transitioning to especially clean energy, which Africa has in abundance, whether you're talking about hydro or solar and wind and all that, hydrogen, I think transitioning to these clean energy sources, especially since Africa is only now building its own energy infrastructure, so it's at a early stage of this process, and so it's in a good position to be able to do that. So certainly growth and development in Africa has to be greener, and I think African policymakers need to be thinking about this. This too is another factor in the policymaking process that we've just been talking about that needs to be looked at very very carefully. In addition to, of course, the kinds of technology that could also make an impact. I think digitalization in all its different forms is transforming production processes, and that's not going to go away. So along with a clean energy transition, looking at how best to access technologies, new technologies and clean technologies and so on, is going to be key as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So this has been super insightful. Moving on to your career for a penultimate question, could you share some insights into how experiences such as assignments at the African Union, the UN Development Programme and the UN Economic Commission for Africa, with postings in Geneva, Ethiopia, Zimbabwe and more, have shaped your career, as well as some advice for students at the LSE aspiring to pursue such roles?
Yeah. I think most people would say that they didn't set off to do, you know, the things they've done. It all happened, in an unplanned way, and I think that applies to my case. But looking back, I think what really has been pivotal is being able to network with people. Studied with people I studied with here at the LSE, because I did my undergraduate studies here, and some graduate studies as well. And then keeping in touch with these people, because as you all move into careers and all that, you do have a network. And people that you meet at conferences and various other places, making sure that you are networked with them. By the way, it's getting easier and easier because we have all these social media tools that makes it easy to connect. But the key thing is that once you're well networked, when there are openings in these organizations that you mentioned, your name is out there. And when you apply for something, because your name is out there, people do look at what it is that you're applying for very carefully. And, that's just the way the world works. And if you fit into the goals that you're interested in, there's a greater chance that people who know you, who know the work that you've done, would be looking at, how they could work with you and so on. So I would say networking is key, and and the rest is luck, really.
Finally, a question we ask all economists on our podcast. What gives you hope?
The human spirit. I think the human spirit is one that overcomes obstacles. One that is always seeking progress in one form or the other. So that's what gives me hope and optimism, that we always want to do things better and improve on what we've done. I think as long as we all doing that, all rowing in that direction, I think we could make the, we could change the world.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We were so, so happy to have you on our podcast on our new season of The Beverage Report.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Beverage Report podcast, interviewing our very own Professor David Luke of the Firoz Lalji Institute for Africa at the LSE. We definitely recommend having a look at Professor Luke's recently published book, How Africa Trades. And to access more of his research discussed in the podcast, please visit www.lse.ac.uk/Africa/people/staff/David-Luke. If you found this episode interesting, please tune into our other episodes on Spotify or on our website. And to be notified when we upload a new episode, follow us on Instagram at Beverage Report. And if you have any suggestions or feedback for us, please reach out over email to a.kaur8@lse.ac.uk. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.